This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with revelations about Boston's original Olympic bid and public money.
We think the only thing that this bid book proves is that the bid does not work without significant taxpayer financing.
Also, the debate over the T. Beacon Hill pushes back on Governor Charlie Baker's plan to trim transportation spending.
I think consistently across the board that revenue is an important part of the larger discussion.
And the struggle to open up the state's public records laws to the light of day.
Case after case after case after case, you give them the money and they still take another 6 months before they give you the documents. And why do they do that? Because they can.
To talk about these stories and the rest of the week's news, we're joined by Joan Vanocki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us.
Also with us is John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and a WBUR senior analyst. John, always a pleasure to see you.
Always good to see you.
All right. Let's start with the Boston 2024 story and these documents that were unearthed this week from Boston's original Olympic bid. This is the so-called bid book that Boston 2024 prepared for the U.S. Olympic Committee. They suggested that, in fact, bringing the Olympics to Boston might require public spending, something that Boston 2024 has repeatedly said publicly is not the case. Now, Boston 2024 says the bid documents have already changed and it stands by its commitment that the games and the building of venues will be privately funded. But here's Chris Dempsey, co-chair of No Boston Olympics. He was on our program yesterday. Here's what he said about the bid book.
It's really making clear that the Olympics were always going to be publicly funded or significantly publicly funded. And what Boston 2024 has been saying to the public at large is very different than the documents they're submitting to the USOC when they're behind closed doors.
So, Joan, I'd love to start with you on this. What do you think this does to the whole debate about the Olympics and the discussion across the city and the state?
Well, first, I'd just like to say, what were they thinking? I'd like to know who decided to redact those parts of what was submitted to the public. And secondly, you couldn't hand a better narrative to opponents like Chris Dempsey, who now can say that they have been less than honest, in fact, dishonest about what's really needed for the Olympics. I guess the bottom line is what they hand in June to Governor Charlie Baker. But I have trouble seeing this get off the ground. It seems like every time they try to do a reset, they get slapped back with good reason.
What do you think, John?
These guys are the Emily Latella of organizing committees. You know, I mean, everything they say, well, we didn't really mean that. We meant something else. You know, this bid book, they called it a proof of concept. And, you know, what it proved is they don't have a clue about what they're doing. They don't have anything lined up. They keep saying they have things lined up. Apparently, they don't have things lined up. They're hiding the fact that there are all kinds of financial shenanigans in here that they're also hiding from the public. They're basing their bid on things that are not going to happen. An expansion of the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center is part of their bid. Well, Charlie Baker just put a freeze on that. So that's not going to happen. So I think part of the bid book talks about how they're socializing the idea of hosting the 2024 Games. They've done the worst job of that you could possibly imagine. And the more these things come out, the more the public looks at it and says, this is five-ring Monty. It's just all sleight of hand. There's nothing really there.
You know, Joan, what strikes me more than anything, I mean, you know, I could accept, I don't have any trouble accepting the argument from Boston 2024 that, look, these were the documents that we submitted way back when, things change. Okay, let's take them at their word. But it all points to the importance of public disclosure. I mean, you know, like you said, why redact? Why not just put all this stuff out to begin with?
Why redact when your theme all along is transparency?
Yeah.
And I also think this is starting to turn really ugly for Mayor Marty Walsh. From the beginning, he pledged transparency. In fact, that was supposedly a theme of his administration. And at this point, I'm really not sure if he's for the Olympics or against the Olympics. I mean, I think he needs to send a much clearer message about where he stands on this whole thing. And again, to get back to what you raised, I mean, if transparency was their theme, they've done anything but. It really is a mess right now.
Well, let's hear from Marty Walsh. He has been a big supporter of the Olympic bid, and he did respond to questions about the potential use of city money. And he said he, in fact, wouldn't oppose city money if it accrued to sort of the long-term benefit of the city. Here's what he said.
It would have to be a tax revenue proposal that would benefit the city of Boston long term for increased taxes. And again, when I say that, I'm just talking about tax incentives. I'm not talking about financing.
There's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. John, final word from you on this story.
You have to feel bad for Marty Walsh and Charlie Baker. I mean, their heads are spinning like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. Every time they turn around, they've been blindsided by these guys. And so I don't blame them for being tentative about everything they say at this point, because there's nothing they can really hang their hat on in terms of reliable information from this committee. So I'm starting to feel really bad for both of them.
I don't feel that badly for Marty Walsh. He signed the bid.
Good point. His signature is on it. That's a good point. I was just thinking, John, you were saying about head spinning. It was this week also that Charlie Baker said that he had no idea that an expanded convention center was part of the original December bid that we saw in this bid book. So
right. This is like telling the truth a little bit at a time for the committee, and it's just not working for him.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another issue that had to do with public records or public disclosures, and that is Massachusetts public records laws. In this case, it actually worked out because due to a request, a FOIA request made to UMass, that's how that bid book became public. But usually it is definitely not so easy in the state of Massachusetts. So here's Scott Allen, editor of the Globe Spotlight team, who kind of gave us a little bit of a taste about how hard it is to shine a light on public records in Massachusetts.
Case after case after case after case, you give them the money and they still take another 6 months before they give you the documents. And why do they do that? Because they can, because there are so few penalty provisions. There's no reason not to. If you're a government bureaucrat, saying no and stonewalling is the smart course.
All right. Well, we're talking about this because this week there was a hearing on Beacon Hill considering two bills that would significantly update Massachusetts' really atrocious and out-of-date public records laws. So, John, let's start with you. First of all, why are we so bad here? Like, most of the rest of the nation actually shines more light on government paper than we do in Massachusetts.
Right. Remember, this is the land of never write when you can talk, never talk when you can nod, never nod when you can wink. So there's a tradition here. I mean, it's an amazing set of guidelines that they have. There's 60 pages of guidelines. One-third of them are exceptions to what will be brought forth as public records. So basically they've rigged the system so that they don't have to reveal the most important things, the financial disclosures that public officials file. Those reports are there so that the public can find out whether they have conflict of interest, what kind of financial arrangements they have outside of their public office, that kind of thing. You can't get them. Basically, it's almost impossible to get them. And so the very purpose of some of these public records is undercut by the guidelines
right.
that they have.
I mean, it's actually kind of more than a little embarrassing because Massachusetts, according to the State Integrity Project, gets an F on this. An F. I mean, we talked to someone in Ohio. Ohio got a C minus. But even in Ohio, like the person was telling us, hey, you know, we made a request for some public records around redistricting. We got 24 boxes in 3 weeks full of information for free, which, Joan, just is unimaginable happening here in the state. As
I
the laws currently
we
stand.
Will all be on the same side on this particular topic, in favor of sunshine. And I do think there's a huge disconnect between, despite what John said about winking and nodding and all that, this idea of a cradle of liberty and shining city on a hill, but the reality being that a lot of things are kept in shadows on Beacon Hill, and that's really kind of sad. And in the past, maybe it did cost money to make copies of things, but now you could just put it online.
But they would say that the cost of digitizing all the stuff is prohibitive as well.
Well, they've got their excuses. I just wonder what will change, if anything.
But Joan,
there were some forceful arguments made, and there's some powerful advocates for sunshine. So far, they've resisted.
Joan, you raise such an interesting paradox, though. Cradle of Liberty, Beacon Hill, et cetera, and yet worst laws on this issue in the country. Why? What explains that?
Well, I think that we've got sort of a mythic narrative going, and we hold ourselves out one way, but when you look behind the scenes and you see what the truth is, in this case, there's no, an F is an F, and that's not a good grade anywhere.
But Ohio, you know, Ohio gets a C, but they live in Ohio. So, you know, there's that. But the other thing is...
Connecticut got a B+. They rank the highest. They're next door.
Great state to drive through. So the interesting thing is how many news organizations are disenfranchised by the system as it stands. The Globe can, if it wants, pony up $14,000 to get public records. But most organizations don't have the resources, the time, the finances, the legal advice, all of that, to overcome all these roadblocks. So the number of news organizations that can hold the state accountable becomes increasingly smaller all the time.
Right.
All right. Well, let's move on to the MBTA and Governor Baker's effort to reform it, get it under control. Last week, as we've mentioned, the Senate supported a fiscal and management control board to oversee the T that the governor wanted. But this week, there was some pushback on a number of issues. The Boston Carmen's Union came out against the governor's plan for a financial control board because they see it as a threat to collective bargaining rights, and they vowed to sue the state if Baker gets his way on some of these issues. Then on Wednesday, the House and Senate Joint Transportation Committee met to discuss the governor's plan, including a proposal to suspend the Pacheco Law, which would allow the hiring of private contractors at lower rates, potentially. And here's Senator Thomas McGee, a Democrat from Lynn, expressing concerns about the governor's plan to cut $500 million in transportation spending.
I think consistently across the board that revenue is an important part of the larger discussion. And it was a small piece in the panel report, but clearly it was a statement they made that it's reform and revenue.
So, Joan, steps along the way of this long effort to reform the T. What do you see? Where do you see the governor's plan right now?
Good question. I think for Governor Baker, this is kind of a win-win. Either he gets the control or some of the control that he wants, or he looks like he's fighting the good fight. So I don't really see him on the losing side of it. I think the Carmen's Union has taken an interesting tact. After decades of sort of being this power behind the scenes, they have pulled back the curtain, and they're speaking to the press, and they're making statements, and they're going public with their position. They obviously have support in the legislature. And I think I wonder how much change will actually come out of this. I think they may stand to win.
Interesting.
On the flip side, yeah, the Carmen's Union is not the most reliable source of information. They're running radio ads right now, and in them they say, despite the terrible winter, fully 95% of the million-plus trips made each year have been completed on time. They define completed on time as actually happened, as opposed to reached a destination on schedule. If you take the latter definition, which most people would, according to Commonwealth Magazine, it's more like 70%. So I think there's a lot of vested interest here. There's a big tug of war going on. I think people should be wary of the information that's being circulated out there, because I don't think that all of it is entirely reliable.
You know, to me, John, I was just going to jump in here, because I was going to say, to me, the real story is actually the one that's forthcoming, that is if the governor does get his fiscal control board, then it's his, right? And so what happens then? I mean, will he make the decisions? Will the board make the decisions to actually get the T back on track, for lack of a better term? Like, the machinations we're seeing now are interesting, but the decisions that will actually be made, to me, are even more compelling, and we've yet to see.
I say good for Governor Baker that he's willing to take ownership of it. And yes,
right,
there is risk in that,
right,
but he seems to really think that getting control is the first step to making the T something that we all need and can rely on.
But John, you know, I was intrigued by what Joan said. It's a win-win for the governor, because he gets points for trying. Maybe he gets points for actually doing something. What about a potential win for T customers? I mean, do you think this is all going to end up in a better place for them?
You would hope so, but I think they have to sort out what they want to do. This sort of push-pull between reform and revenue is something that needs to get sorted out, because essentially most people think you're not going to improve the T unless you have new net revenue. And admittedly, they haven't done so well managing the money that they've had up to this point, but it just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. So the things should go hand in hand. Some people want them to go sequentially, that reform first, revenue second, a number of people think these should go hand in hand mm-hmm. because you're not really going to be able to make the most of the reforms unless you have some kind of new revenue. So it may be that the T-Rider is going to have to foot more of the bill to get the kind of service that they're clamoring for and that, frankly, they deserve.
Right. And in fact, transit advocates would say reform before revenue is the refrain we've been hearing for decades, and we're still at the place that we are. Well, let's talk about one more story before time runs out too much, and that, of course, has to do with Boston Public the Boston Public Library. There was obviously the big scandal about the missing Rembrandt and Dürer prints, and now this week we also found out that some gold coins may be missing and that they could have disappeared several decades ago. So, Joan, let's start with you. I mean, the troubles at BPL seem to go ever deeper and deeper. Just your first reaction to this latest chapter in this.
Well, I have to say, I don't have the slightest idea of what's happening there. I mean, I see the library president is vowing to boost security, and it seems like the horse is out of the barn, and they've definitely got a problem. But if it goes back decades, I don't know how responsible the current library president is. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more to be told in this story, I guess is how I would frame it.
John?
Yeah, there seems to be a real lack of communication at the public library because it was known to some of the employees at the library that those prints were missing a year ago. And Amy Ryan, the president of the BPL, didn't find out until, April? And then we find out a little bit later. I don't know why she wouldn't know and employees would. They said, we thought she knew, so we didn't tell her. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I don't know if they should institute some system of library fines, like when you bring a book back late. If you report this stuff.
I mean, if you lose a Rembrandt, you pay a pretty big fine.
Exactly.
To me, what really gets me is that this lays bare one of the fundamental challenges that great public libraries like the BPL have, right? It's a public institution. We, the great unwashed, are supposed to be able to go in there and see Rembrandts and see Dürers, if in those special collections. But then on the other hand, they said to the Globe, we can't be Fort Knox, but you can catalog these things. I mean, they apparently didn't have an exhaustive catalog of their greatest treasures.
Because they don't have the money, and I think one of the things they need to do is go out and raise some private money. They're not going to get what they really need from the city of Boston, and that's understandable. There's a lot of priorities for the city of Boston, but they should be out there, to me anyway, going out and raising private funds and name a room after somebody and put it, digitize things.
No, John, maybe what they should do is offer to be an Olympics venue.
That could be. Maybe
then
actually.
Then they get some money. Maybe a tax credit or something.
Cataloging the collection could be an Olympic event.
The next spelling bee needs to be held at the BPL. That's what I think.
That would help a lot.
But do either of you think, are we moving toward a kind of clamor for a change in leadership at the BPL? I mean, it just seems extraordinary to me that these things have gone missing and we're continuing to make new discoveries about things that are gone missing, and yet I haven't really heard a conversation about the need for a change in leadership.
Well, I think I saw a press release from somewhere calling for Amy Ryan to resign, and I said earlier that these things have been happening for decades, but she has been there 7 years, so the book does stop at the top or something like that.
I think she's gotten pretty good marks for any number of in any number of areas up to now. So I think that she's got probably more support than she might otherwise have. She's done a good job in the branches. I think she's heading up a renovation downtown, a much needed renovation in the main library downtown. And I think overall people have been happy with her her tenure so far. So I wonder, it would be too bad if this wipes everything out, but it would also be understandable if it wipes everything out because it's a pretty big deal.
I guess what I'd like to hear now is just a clear enunciation of what they're going to do so it doesn't happen again. So.
That would be nice, but again, it all comes down to money.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to our hubbubs, those stories that might not have made it to the top of the news this week, but that caught the attention of our Week in Review team. Joan, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, I was just going to make note that Bob Schieffer is signing off as host of Face the Nation after something like 24 years, and he is going out on his own terms with his, I guess, integrity and character intact, which is a good thing in today's media world. And there was an interesting piece in the New York Times which pointed out that His greatest successes came after the age of 65. He brought the audience to the highest levels. He wrote a memoir, and he became a moderator of presidential debates. And it was kind of like, I don't know if the theme is that he's now 77, so maybe 77 is the new 60. But he's going out on a high note.
He is indeed. What a steady news hand he has been. I'm glad you raised Bob Schieffer's final appearance on
Especially
Face the Nation.
Especially in the Brian Williams age.
Nice contrast, yeah. Right?
Right.
John, what about you?
Well, as we all know, United States Senator Bernie Sanders has many admirable qualities, not least of which is his ability to live in Vermont for upteen years and not lose his Brooklyn accent.
What are you doing with hating all over these various New England states of ours?
I'm not hating.
It's the Brooklyn accent.
It's the Brooklyn accent that he's maintained.
I was born in Brooklyn.
There you go. See, you've lost yours, though. Anyway, most people know that he's a socialist. Not many people know he's also a singer. Back in the late 80s, while he was mayor of Burlington, he recorded an album of folk classics in spite of apparently having no musical talent whatsoever. Here's what the producer of the album, Todd Lockwood, said to the Vermont website 7 Days. As talented of a guy as he is, he has absolutely not one musical bone in his body, and that becomes painfully obvious from the get-go. This is a guy who couldn't even tap his foot to music coming over the radio. No sense of melody, no sense of rhythm, which is probably why they named the album We Shall Overcome. At any rate...
Sorry, took me a second.
Why don't we just take a listen to a little bit of it?
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
I love it.
So, right. So...
So this is actually happening. So, like, we just broadcast that.
Yeah. So the best thing would be if he cut a new album, right, for his presidential campaign. I think it would be a big hit. He could call it We Shall Overcount. And, I think it would give a real boost to his campaign. Right.
Didn't Mitt Romney try to sing in the last campaign? And not very well, if I recall.
He did sing. They were desperate to make him stop, but he wouldn't.
Magna, what about your hubbub? These are hard to talk.
I was going to say, it's not fair to make me have to follow that from John. But mine, oh gosh. Okay, but mine is good news for commuters, because it was a while ago that Jim Sturgis, who's a frequent guest right where you're sitting, John, on our Week in Review panel from the Pioneer Institute, he was talking about how on the Tobin Bridge, the all-electronic pay-by-plate system for tolls across the bridge was really costing a lot of people a lot of money because late fees and fines were stacking up quite quickly to the point of thousands and thousands of dollars drivers were getting bills. So it turns out that the Baker administration is catching up to all of this, and starting on Monday, Jim, if you're listening to this, I know you'll be celebrating, that they are going to offer a toll amnesty to delinquent Tobin Bridge users. Then they'll also see a revised fine structure for unpaid tolls. And this is actually really great news because some of those fines were, as I was saying, in the thousands of dollars. So commuters, rejoice. A wrong has been or is going to be made right. And you can pay your fine in full or have your fines waived all the way dating back to July 21st of 2014. So that's a lot of money.
Wow. Next, you know, he'll be chopping down the toll booths like Bill Weld did.
Yeah. All right. Well, here's my hub. A beautiful spring day today, 75 degrees, 80 degrees. I was out by the Mystic River behind Assembly Station in Somerville, where there was a big reminder of the record-breaking winter that we all just suffered through. And I was there with Patrick Heron. He's with the Mystic River Watershed Association, and he described what we were looking at.
Debris and mud and dirt and sand, and underneath that is the remnants of the winter snowstorms of February and January.
So it's still snow. There's a pile of snow there. Let's call it what it is.
There's a pile of snow that's perhaps a bit insulated now by all the debris, the chairs that you put out in front of your parking spot there, the broken shovel, I bet we could really go on a treasure hunt here.
Plastic bottles, parking cones, all kinds of garbage and junk. It is sort of an environmental issue, isn't it? I mean, we need to think about this.
Absolutely. And, I think in the best case scenario, you have land set aside, snow farms, if you will, where that snow can melt and that contaminated material, the road runoff, the salt, can run into a place that where it can be treated and infiltrate or be removed to a landfill. And every city in the Boston area is facing this challenge in cleaning up these last snow piles. And hopefully we're all thinking about next season and how we're going to do it a little better than we did it this season.
A pile of snow from the winter of 2015 is still melting. Well, all right, on this Friday in May, I'm going to finally say goodbye to the snow from the winter of 2015. Bye, snow.
Bye.
We won't miss you, but you'll be back.
Well, that's it for This Week in Review. Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, thanks for being with us. Always great to have you.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
And John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and WBUR senior analyst. John, don't ever bring that kind of tape back to Week in Review again.
I promise I will not.
You can come back with that tape.
I promise I will not.
And stay with us. Coming up, feeling welcome at museums and the message we send our kids. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.